is by Yahweh's Design with Pastor Dan. And now here's your host, Pastor Dan.
Welcome, everybody, to By Yahweh's Design. I am Pastor Dan, your host for this one-hour live radio program coming to you over Heritage Broadcasting System. We're coming to you via the Internet, C-band satellites, and in some areas, fortunately, FM rebroadcasters, our Paul Revere's for today. We want to thank each and every one of you and pray Yahweh bless and guide each and every one of you. First and foremost, we dedicate this program to our Heavenly Father, Yahweh, the father of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who was later surnamed Israel. For all good things come from him, and we give him all the praise, the glory, and the honor for allowing us this opportunity to bring his truth to his holy remnant, the lost sheep of the house of Jacob Israel, also known as the Caucasian peoples of the earth. Hallelujah, Yahweh, all praise Yahweh in Hebrew. This is a two-seed line racial covenant identity ministry, and we've been studying this truth for a number of years, and a goal of our program is to get truth out to the people. There's a famine for truth in this land today, and it's our goal to get truth out to you. And we ask if you send in any suggestions, any comments, or contributing information to us, either via mail, email. Tonight's program is entitled Trading on Guilt. And in a short bit, I'm going to have the author of a book that's entitled Trading on Guilt as my guest, and we're going to discuss the Jewish situation as far as the public schools and the Holocaust education that's being forced down our children's throats. But before we go too much further, I want to read a little ad here for you. So get involved, folks. Be part of the solution and not part of the problem. We need to educate people, and we need to educate them fast. Also, if you have any health concerns, we would suggest you talk to Judy at Salt Box Herbs, and you can contact Judy at 724-639-9607. And again, I'm in a remote location in Pennsylvania tonight talking to you, so Charisse is not going to be able to contribute with her poetry. But again, tonight is Trading on Guilt. My guest that I'll have on here shortly is the author, who is Philip E. Glidden, Ph.D., out of Orlando, Florida. And we're going to be discussing, again, the Holocaust education and the push for it in the public school systems. Has Philip called in yet?
Yes.
Oh, Philip, you're on the line?
I'm on the line here.
Oh, excellent. I just want to read your short biography out of the book here to the folks so they have a little bit of an idea of where your background is here. Philip E. Glidden, Ph.D., was born in Presque Isle, Maine. Philip is a graduate of Bowdoin. Okay, College and Boston University. He has worked in field geology in Canada and the United States, and taught geology, geography, and related subjects for 6 years in the public schools and college. The author has also been involved in the real estate and land development business in New York for 20 years. A world traveler and writer on current affairs, Glidden is currently working on a second book relating to religious and race-related issues. As an avid bicyclist, Glidden has toured Europe on several occasions, and in 1995 spent 6 weeks cycling in Greece, Crete, Israel, and Egypt. Before we get too much into this, I wanted to tell the folks, again, the title of the book is Trading on Guilt. Its ISBN number is 0-7392-0322-3. And we're going to offer this book through this ministry also. If you write to us, we'll be glad to send one to you, post-date, of course. And I want to redo the introduction to the book, Philip, because I think it's pretty interesting here. It says, this book is dedicated to the freedom of inquiry into even the most forbidden regions of human involvement. No man should shrink from revealing the truth, since in the long run, he is accountable to himself alone. I thought that was pretty good. So, Philip, if you would, tell the folks just a brief description of how, you know, this book came about, you know, what led you to want to write it and what you were involved with.
Okay. I'm a resident now of Florida, being retired. And back in 1994, I had read about it in the newspapers that a Holocaust course law, that is, was being prepared for introduction into the Florida legislature. And I thought to myself, after having read about it, that, you know, this was really unnecessary, and wondering what the purpose was. And this is essentially what led me to investigate it further. And what I discovered was really astonishing to me, in view of the fact that the only people that had promoted this particular law, which is Florida Statute 233.061F, if anyone wants to look it up in the Florida Statutes book, it was enacted into law in 1994, signed into law by Governor Childs, then Governor Childs, and almost immediately thereafter, it was put in the hands of the then Commissioner of Education, Frank Brogan, who is now Lieutenant Governor, rather, of the state of Florida. And he immediately appointed a committee of people who, it turned out to be, were primarily those who were supposed to provide recommendations, but instead they took the bit in their teeth and proceeded to essentially bring this educational course into the public schools without any peer oversight as to the content. They set up areas where teachers would be so-called taught, I say indoctrinated. And this is essentially how this particular law was implemented in the public school system. And it was really astonishing to the effect that when I tried to find out something about it, this committee was called the Task Force, Commissioner's Task Force on Holocaust Education. When I tried to determine how the members of this committee had been appointed, from what area they were chosen, and what their responsibility was, I found myself to be essentially thwarted in every end. And when they finally began to have meetings, we in the state of Florida, I think in many states as well, they have what we call a sunshine law, which requires that all state meetings be held open to the public. But this particular organization refused to have open meetings, and it, to make a long story short, it necessitated me finally having to sue them to gain access to the committee, which, in fact, up to this very date, I have never been able to attend.
Somehow I don't find that surprising. Now, this book, Trading on Guilt, the premise or the background on the title is basically what you found, as I read your book anyway, is you determined that it's pretty much the Jews who are behind getting this legislation into, I forget the term now, but they get the bill put before the different branches of the government.
Absolutely. In fact, as I determined later on, the law as written was essentially taken from writings of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., which is a quasi-government agency primarily run by Jews who are primarily themselves victims in some way of the Holocaust. And it was their experts who wrote the law, which then was modified very, very little and introduced into the Florida Senate and the Florida House of Representatives by Jewish members of the Senate and the House of Representatives. And I have recordings of the hearings in committee, and there was virtually no opposition made to these laws, because it was revealed in the newspapers that any legislator, that is, who might feel that they would like to vote against this particular law would be looked upon with disfavor by Jews in the state of Florida, whoever they might be. And judging by the enormous amount of influence that Jewish legislators and others in the state have, most legislatures felt it was best to preserve their position and vote for the law. Although I think in most cases, having read and looked at the proceeds of these committees, practically nobody knew anything about it. Then finally, when the law was enacted, the material from which was to be fed into the public school system by this so-called advisory committee, the Task Force on Holocaust Education, was almost completely composed of Jewish people, most of whom were associated with Jewish Holocaust centers in the state of Florida, two of whom were also associated with the United States Memorial Museum, Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. So it was a pretty much of an intersanguine type of relationship here, in which all of the material from the standpoint of what was to be taught to the children was pretty much manufactured in the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and other Holocaust centers. And this, of course, in my view, is why the task force did not want others attending their meetings and finding out exactly what was going on.
So basically the public is totally unaware of what they're up to.
Well, I think that's true. The promotion of the law was enormous. I mean, when this law came up for introduction into the legislature in the state of Florida, the newspapers were filled with a need for it. The Orlando Sentinel, for example, had an article which was to point out where a bunch of skinheads had almost killed a young Jewish guy who was a member of their group. And there was an enormous amount of promotion made to suggest there was a great deal of anti-Semitism, racism, and so forth in the state of Florida, which could only be counteracted by this particular Holocaust law. After the law, this is interesting to me, was that after the law was enacted, and it was in the process of being implemented into the state school systems, after that, these people, these skinheads and so forth and so on, literally disappeared from the state of Florida.
Right.
So this was pretty much of a put-up job, and even the article that was written in the Orlando Sentinel revealed the fact that the Anti-Defamation League, which is the premier Jewish propaganda machine here in Miami, was providing the information with regard to the article that was printed by the Orlando Sentinel. So Jewish groups of all sizes and shapes and so forth were all behind this law, and I discovered that the person who became the chairman of this task force had been promoting this thing from essentially the middle 80s, and you know, almost 10 years prior to the time that the law was actually initiated here in the state of Florida. So there was a tremendous amount of preparation, very little revealed to the public in general, and the idea was to get this thing promoted and written up and enacted into law, and then it was to be managed primarily by members of the Jewish community, most of whom were in some way victims of the Holocaust, whether they themselves had been victimized by the Holocaust personally or whether they were the descendants of Holocaust victims.
Or so they claim.
Well, yeah, I think this is primarily true, because I think it was primarily the rage, the indignation, the sense of outrage, and the need for perhaps revenge that motivated these people more than, say, Jews who did not have this experience. And I find that to be true in other states as well, where Holocaust courses have been brought into public school. I mean, for example, Michigan and New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and so forth. So that, as I say, they've been brought in very, very easily, and primarily the reason for it is because of the fact that the use of guilt has been imposed upon the public in general, saying that, you know, look what happened to the Jews. I mean, everyone, of course, is, if they have any sense at all, would have some remorse as to what happened to Jews during World War II, in which they were almost exterminated, so that it was essentially easy for the imposition of guilt to be used on the general public and the students to be used to effectuate these laws in the public school systems.
Okay.
And this is where my title comes, A Trading on Guilt, using guilt almost as a commodity to effectuate this particular type of law.
Mm-hmm. You have focused primarily, though, on their attack of the school system and their manipulation of the legislature in order to get preferential treatment for their particular bills to indoctrinate our children on the issue of the Holocaust.
Oh, absolutely. There has been absolutely no opposition. I mean, aside from my minor bit of opposition here, as far as I can determine, there's been virtually no opposition to this whatsoever. And I believe it's due to the fact that the Holocaust has become pretty much of a sacrosanct area of Jewish religion, and it's now observed on an annual basis as Rosh Hashanah, and it is becoming more and more inculcated into the Jewish religion. So therefore, it's becoming more and more sanctified and more religiously anointed. So the contestation there is pretty much of a religious nature now.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my objection in this regard is that there has to be a separation between church and state, and yet the Holocaust, which is now so religiously endowed, has been pretty much taken over by the state, and there's now a commingling of state and religion which is prohibited under the First Amendment. And I and others here in the state of Florida intend to file suit in due course to try to loosen this relationship and actually try to overturn this particular law and get it out of schools.
Well, I wish you well in that endeavor, since they have a tremendous amount of influence and power over the legislatures and the courts. So
I do indeed, but I can tell you one thing very, very handily, and I suggest others consider this very, very closely when they're dealing with matters of this nature, is that when you get somebody into court, whereas I have done with regard to, I actually sued the state of Florida and this Holocaust task force because they hadn't observed the Sunshine Law. And it was a cut-and-dried situation since there was no evidence that they had observed this law. And I was able to prevail. And when I got people into court, their religion played no part. And for the first time, I discovered that essentially Jewish people were somewhat befuddled when they came to the realization that the people were not going to bow and scrape as others had done, the legislatures had done, and other people had done when they had effectuated this Holocaust law in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the courts are definitely the way to go. Of course, if we wait too long and the First Amendment is destroyed, which I think is well in the making, then it'll be too late. So I think anybody that has any willpower in this regard should file suit without delay if they have that particular situation in their state.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your course of fighting this, you noted in the book, and I believe you stated that there is a tremendous amount of control through intimidation and their power of the press and their power to vilify somebody who stands.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is absolutely true. I mean, if you go in, I mean, I have actually gone to the school systems. I've talked with principals. I've talked to teachers. I've even talked to students on occasion, friends of mine who's children have gone and taken these courses. There is a tremendous amount of apprehension that if anyone should be caught in any way, shape, or manner disagreeing with this program, then their job is on the line. And essentially what is happening is the freedom of expression, the freedom of academic endeavor is at stake by having this kind of a forced law on the state books. To give you an example of the extent to which this material has accumulated, in 1999, I was able to discover that a 900-page volume on the Holocaust is to be brought into the 9 through 12 curriculum. Now, this is more material than is taught in all of the history courses, European or American, throughout the school system. It's beyond belief. So not only is this a course curriculum that is totally designed and written by the Jewish community, especially out of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., but there has been no peer overview of this material, so that what is being inculcated into the public school system has had no peer review whatsoever from anybody. Parent teachers associations, principals associations, superintendents, nothing. So it is pure propaganda without any question, and I think that if this thing is brought to court properly and eventually has to go to the Supreme Court, I think it will be adjudged as an infraction of the First Amendment without any question. The only problem is that people are absolutely frightened of their jobs, and they don't dare to raise any kind of, not even a mild outcry in opposition to these things. And another way of looking at this thing is that they're unnecessarily imposing guilt on young people for what happened to Jews over 50 years ago in a foreign country that for which the students and their parents had absolutely no complicity whatsoever. And this is totally unnecessary, but the reason behind it from the standpoint of the Jewish people that have brought this forth is that they are so afraid that another Holocaust might occur that the idea is to impose a sense of guilt into young people so deeply and to program their minds so completely that when they become adults, they will essentially be stopped, as it were, from ever being a problem for the Jewish community at a later time. In other words, this is a means of conditioning young people to prevent them, when they become adults, from ever becoming a danger to the Jewish community. Well, I mean, this is all very well and good for the Jewish community, but certainly I don't think any parent wants their children to be programmed and indoctrinated in this way. I mean, in America, the idea is to provide the best possible education you can for young people and let them make up their own minds as to the truth of history. So the indoctrination of young people is totally against the American system, and when I think the people of the United States begin to realize what Holocaust education really amounts to, I think they'll be willing to come up and take a stand against it, hopefully.
Well, I think you hit on a key point there. If they become aware of it, of course, now again, I pointed out earlier that you focused primarily on Holocaust education in the public schools. I and my associates, we've been looking at how they operate on a broad spectrum.
Right.
And their modus operandi is exactly the same. It has no difference whether we're talking Holocaust training to our young children or any other program that these people seem to get involved with.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that a few Jewish writers, are actually coming out and with the realization in some books that this thing is being overdone. They call it the Holocaustia. In other words, the veneration of the Holocaust. It's essentially become the crux of the Jewish religion. It's been the rallying point of the Jewish religion. It's extremely important to bring Jewish people together, the Holocaust. And a lot of people have the realization that if the Holocaust was not venerated in this way, that there would be far less of a solid relationship among Jewish people, and that they would have a different point of view. But, I mean, the Holocaust is something that Jewish people today look upon with great awe and consideration and consider it part of their religion, and therefore any person of the Jewish religion who would object to it would essentially be out of the main orbit of Jewish thinking at this point. However, it is beginning to occur. Novicki, I think University of Chicago professor, has come out with Holocaust in America, which is a criticism of this Holocaustia, and I understand other books are being readied which do criticize it. So it's been overdone. And it's interesting, you know, in nature, if we get too many rabbits and we don't have enough wildcats to curtail the rabbits or keep down the number of rabbits while we become over run with rabbits. Fortunately, nature is in juxtaposition. It is able to prevent this from happening. However, with the Holocaust, there has been absolutely no opposition whatsoever, and as a result, it's just become like a tidal wave sweeping everything its path. However, I think now is the time to come and look at it very squarely and realize that it is not good for the children of this country to have this material forced down their throat, because it's nothing but conditioning.
Uh-huh.
And the way to go, in my estimation, is through the courts. I mean, we realize that much of the media is in the hands of Jews who, even if they wanted to present the facts, would be prevented from doing so by the zealots who are essentially in charge of the Holocaust educational paradigm.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, this is essentially in the hands of just a few people. But the people in whose hands it is located are highly motivated. They have a great deal of revenge and hatred in their hearts. And this is what propels them.
Uh-huh.
They want to make sure that society will be safe for their future survival.
Uh-huh.
And this is, in my view, the reason that the Holocaust education in public schools have been pushed so severely.
All right.
As it has.
Well, Philip, we're going to go for a short break here, so just hang on to your thoughts. And ladies and gentlemen, just stay tuned. Don't change the dial. We'll be back in just a few minutes and pick up with more on Trading on Guilt.
Broadcasting worldwide, this is the Heritage Broadcast System.
Not so many years ago, men and women were having children into their 80s and living what we would consider extremely long lives. Since then, we have turned our air to filth, our water toxic, and completely depleted our ground of all vitamins and minerals. Our fresh foods look good but have no substance, and processed foods are pumped full of synthetic vitamins and minerals that our bodies won't absorb. But there are ways of coping with these problems, and Saltbox Herbs has the answers. From the micro water machine that will detox and balance the pH levels of your body to the Qi machine that gives your body the perfect exercise, natural vitamins and minerals your body will use, cleansing and healing regimens that will keep you healthy. Saltbox Herbs, the healthy alternative that you can afford and your body can live with. Call Dr. Judy at 724-639-9607. That's 724-639-9607.
Listen to us worldwide on hbroadcast.com. This is the Heritage Broadcast System.
Purchase your own emergency hand pumping system. Use your own well. An endless supply of water. Easy installation. Less than 1 hour to install by yourself. Pumps 5 to 7 gallons per minute by hand. Pumps on both strokes, up and down. A secure supply of water for your family. When all else fails, DPS will work. No major parts to wear out. No leathers, O-rings, flappers, or rubber parts. The hand pumps are portable and can be installed from well to well. The DPS has an affordable price for a deep well hand pump. Orders filled promptly. We also have water filters. Phone 208-684-3886. That's 208-684-3886.
Welcome back to Yahweh's Design with Pastor Dan. And now here's your host, Pastor Dan.
Welcome back, everybody. Again, tonight's program is Trading on Guilt, and I have the author of this book, Philip Glidden, Ph.D., out of Orlando, Florida, as my guest. Before we go too much further, I want to say Happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. And if you happen to be one of the most oppressed people on the planet, a white father, I especially want to ask the Father in heaven to bless you and strengthen you, because you have to fight an uphill battle no matter what you're doing. And again, my guest is Philip Glidden, Ph.D., the author of the book Trading on Guilt, and we're discussing the Holocaust education that is being forced down the throats of our children in the public school system. Did we interrupt what you were saying there, Philip, or did you finish that thought?
No, I tend to be much too loquacious and wordy, so it's pretty hard to get me to stop talking.
Well, that's fine.
About anything.
I wanted to point out something to you. Now, again, you primarily focused on this one issue, and that's what this book is dedicated to. And for the folks out there who might want to order one, again, you can contact us here. It's an excellent book. And you've got it fully footnoted and everything else, a very good work. But I personally witnessed how they operate, and it fits in exactly with what you're saying. I went down to visit the family in Tampa, so it was right in your state, and I went to a PTA meeting to watch my niece perform some sort of a little play. And right after that, this lady, who was the head of the PTA organization, who happened to be a woman lawyer and happened to be a Jew, was going to get up and present an argument why we needed a law to make our children wear bicycle helmets. So I sat there and I thought, this ought to be good. So she presented this story of a boy from the neighborhood who had been out riding his bicycle, and he had a terrible accident with this bicycle, and he hit his head, and actually he suffered a lifelong debilitating result of this accident, and it could have been prevented had he had a helmet on. I mean, she was quite wordy with just giving us all sort of details about this. So I sat there with my family listening to this, and I remember saying, I'll bet you it's a lie. And of course, back then, they looked at me and thought I was crazy, and I said, but I'd be willing to bet money it's a lie. So as it turns out, 2 or 3 months later, this member of my family calls me up, and I had forgotten about this, and says, guess what? And I said, what? And they said, do you remember this PTA meeting? And I said, I sure do. And they said, well, we started asking questions in the neighborhood about this particular lad that she described, because none of us recognized the name of the boy. And they came to find out that this boy not only did not exist, there was no accident of any boy at any such location at any such time, but this woman had indeed totally made up the story to work upon the emotions of our people, which is a typical tactic, because unfortunately, when we get our emotions turned on, we shut the brains off. And that's exactly what she did, and she gave this total lie to a full house of PTA parents, and in order to get this ridiculous legislation to force our children to wear helmets instead of just letting it up to the parents and the children. So I'm trying to say is, this tactic that they're using, Philip, is exactly the same no matter what the issue is. They go in, they create a situation, they'll make up a total lie, which 99% of the time they do. They'll embellish it with all sorts of emotional garbage so that you'll become emotionally involved, and then they will get what they want. And by the time you've figured out their ruse and that it's a total lie, it's already on the books.
Well, you got to remember that. I mean, the originator of psychoanalysis was Freud, an Austrian Jew, and the Jews, being always a minority in society, have always had a propensity to want to analyze what goes on in the minds of Gentiles amidst whom they live, because it's always been a precarious situation. We have to realize it wasn't until Napoleon came along that around 1810 or thereabouts that the Jews in Europe were actually emancipated. So I wish to, at this point, if I might, point out some interesting books aside from my own that I recommend highly for people to read that deal with the so-called strategy of Jews as a group. And the first, there are a series of three books written by a professor at Long Beach State College in California, University of California in Long Beach, by Kevin MacDonald, K-E-V-I-N-M-A-C-D-O-N-A-L-D. The first of these books was published in 1994, so they're quite recent. It was called A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy. The second book is dealing with anti-Semitism, the origin of anti-Semitism, toward a evolutionary theory of anti-Semitism, also by Kevin MacDonald, published in 1998. And these are put out by Prager, P-R-A-E-G-E-R, publishers in Westport, Connecticut. So they are put out by a highly legitimate publishing firm. And what Kevin MacDonald has done here is go into the strategy of Jews as a whole to essentially keep themselves together as a group evolutionary strategy. There's been very little outbreeding, so to speak, with Gentiles, and this has been pretty much demonstrated by an analysis of the genes, Jewish genes, over the period of time, finding that there hasn't been so much outbreeding with Gentiles over the last 2,000 years, so that they are a very pure group of people, and their religion essentially requires this of them to remain steadfast within their own group. And the thing that has happened throughout Jewish evolution is that the rabbis have always been considered at the very top of their society, and that intelligence has always been highly regarded, and that a father of a young woman would always want his daughter to marry the wisest rabbi. And as a result, through periods of time, Jews have essentially practiced eugenics, which is essentially inbreeding, to produce highly intelligent people. And today we recognize this. The so-called Ashkenazi Jews have intelligence approximately 10% or 10 points above the average American, so that their ability to survive is due to a great extent to their very great intelligence. And whereas other groups in Europe, say, and elsewhere, always placed their best men on the battlefield and killed them off, meaning that the survivors, or the people who were not able to go out on the battlefield and fight, the less able were the ones that carried on the genetic the genes of the people who survived, whereas Jews, for the most part, did not place themselves at risk, and they were able to preserve their best genes over long periods of time. This is essentially what Kevin MacDonald has found. And also through their teachings, they regard out groups as being hostile, beneath them, essentially animals in many cases, so that this has also kept the in-group together. And now we see in modern time Jews coming to this country having been liberated, as I say, back only in the early part of the 19th century, coming forth with the same strategy of self-preservation at any expense. So it's therefore understandable why those who directly experienced the horrors of the Holocaust, which certainly happened, I have no doubts about that whatsoever, it happened, to look upon society with great suspicion. So this is the driving force, in my estimation, that causes people who were directly damaged by the Holocaust to want to condition the rest of society for their own survival purpose.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I would take a slightly different stance as to whether it happened the way they purported to have happened in they certainly have jostled with the numbers.
Yeah, I understand a lot of people are dealing with that. I mean, my primary purpose in writing the book was I felt that this type of education was improper for the public school. I didn't want to get involved with numbers with regard to the Holocaust, whether it actually occurred. I didn't want to get into revisionism, as it was called by various people. And for the most part, I have used Jewish sources in my book deliberately because I wanted to show that I was as unbiased as I could be in dealing with a subject which has a great deal, many ramifications. And of course, as the more I found out about it, I found how completely manipulative society, a Jewish society, has become today. I mean, for example, the Anti-Defamation League essentially invented hate crime laws. Their attorneys, of which they have many, I mean, they have a budget of some $30 or $40 million, and they have a great many attorneys on their staff. And in most cases where states have hate crime laws, for example, these, for the most part, were written, conceived, and brought forth into state legislatures by members, the staff of the Anti-Defamation League, and in many cases they were actually enacted into law almost without change.
Mm-hmm.
From those written by the Anti-Defamation League attorneys. Now, it's an interesting thing. I cover hate to a certain extent in my book, and I think it's, you know, the use of hatred in society is a buzzword which immediately causes people to react in various ways. But if you look into the, if you have an analysis of hatred, you find that essentially when we're talking about hate crimes, that a hate crime is really a misnomer. If somebody really wanted to go into court with a host of psychologists and psychiatrists and various people, biologists and so forth, who are able to analyze emotions, then there would be no such thing as hate crimes. But the way it's being utilized now, of course, is being used to incite society to turn on other members of society as if they were the perpetrators of all crimes. In this case, primarily the white European society, which, of course, it was the white European society, namely the Germans, that perpetrated the Holocaust on the Jews, and it's only understandable that they would have great dislike and hatred and revenge toward the Germans. But unfortunately, this has been enlarged to include just about every white European as being despicable and a group of people that, in their view, should be put down. This is part of the program.
Philip.
Put down and control, essentially.
Yeah. We've got a caller on the line. We've got Willie from Oklahoma. Willie, welcome to the program.
Well, I appreciate it. First off, I'd like to get your address. You always give it, but you give it too doggone fast. I'm a slow... I'm slower than you folks.
Okay.
First off, there's no doubt that the Holocaust is a bunch of crap. That's nothing except Zionists and the Jews in general being able to make money off of other people. Number two is the Jews don't hate us because of what happened to this in the so-called Holocaust. They hate us because we're white Anglo-Saxons, Germanic, Scandinavian, Celtic, and kindred people, are the true children of Israel, and they hate us because we know that, and they've been trying for over 2,000 years to destroy us. They just hadn't been able to do it.
Uh-huh.
So I just wanted to express that opinion because the author there, he appears not to understand that particular reason why they hate white people so bad.
Uh-huh.
And
well,
I just wanted to make that clear.
Right.
Appreciate being allowed to talk, and y'all have a good day.
Okay, well, thank you, Willie.
Bye-bye.
And I would like to make something clear. Maybe the folks that are listening are not sure of where we're coming from here. My idea with this program is not to bring a constant list of people who already know what we know and just constantly reinforce this. My idea is to bring truth wherever it comes from and from whatever viewpoint. And again, I happen to know that Mr. Glidden is not of our faith, and he is not coming at this particular problem from the same point of view that we would. However, he has hit upon a truth in the fact that the Jews are behind pushing a particular agenda known as this Holocaust religion, and that's what it is, a religion, and it's being forced upon our school children. And so, Willie, I understand what you're saying because we're on the same wavelength there, and I've had other guests who have made that point, but as Mr. Glidden said earlier, his object with this book wasn't really to get into the basis of whether the Holocaust existed as they have claimed it to have existed and to the degree that they have claimed it to be so. In fact, even in your book, Philip, I noted where you, I believe you quoted the Red Cross as saying that there were less than a half million Jews in all of Europe at the outbreak of the war. So, again, our point tonight is not to get into the history of the Holocaust as much as it is to expose what they have done in the state of Florida and to warn other people in other states that the same thing might be going on where your legislature has no spines left in them whatsoever when it comes to fighting the Jew on any issue, let alone the issue of this Holocaust education in our school systems. And our people have got to grow backbones, as Mr. Glidden has done, and take them on in the court or anywhere else. You've got to stand up for our people and take these people on. And I think tonight that's the main issue, at least that I'm interested in getting out here to the listening audience, is the fact that you have to discover this stuff and you have to fight it. And would you agree with that, Philip?
Well, first of all, let me say, the Red Cross number of Jews, I don't remember having quoted that. If I did, it's erroneous.
Okay.
I do have some statistics in there which were put forth by the Jewish historian Lucy Davidovich, who estimates the number of Jews that were in Poland and so forth. Actually, the greatest Jewish population just prior to World War II was probably in Poland. I don't know how many were in Russia. Of course, those in Russia were not brought to the Holocaust centers as primarily the Poles were, and many German Jews had already left because they were a wealthier group of people and had the wherewithal to leave Germany when the persecutions began as early as 1933. But whereas Polish Jews, of which there are a great number of Jews in Poland, were more pestilent stock and therefore didn't have the wherewithal to leave, and plus they were further away from safety in Eastern Europe. But getting back to the situation, I would like to point out that yes, indeed, there are many states that have Holocaust education, whether it has been mandated or not, and California is one of them, Illinois is one of them, and the situation in Illinois is rather interesting, and I have a chapter in there about it, is that it began back in the late 70s, 1970s, when an incident occurred in which a Jew by the name of Cohn, who changed his name to Colin, became head of the local Nazi party and applied for a permit to stage a rally for the American Nazi party in Skokie, Illinois. Excuse me. Now, Skokie, Illinois was a place where a great many Jewish Holocaust victims had come to reside. And when this, it's interesting that Mr. Colin, who is actually the son of a Holocaust victim, being a Jew himself, had actually perpetrated this encounter, which became a cause célèbre, and actually involved eventually the courts, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Supreme Court. But of interest in this is that the Jewish community there in the city of Skokie went to great lengths to try to prevent this march from taking place. And the Anti-Defamation League was involved, and they actually came up, they were so desperate for a reason to try to prevent the Nazi party there from parading in that town, that they invented a term called menticide, M-E-N-T-I-C-I-D-E, which was supposed to suggest that if a Jewish child saw a Nazi in uniform, that this would essentially cause brain death, menticide. Now, this is a word you won't find in the dictionary. It was invented, and it was actually tried to be brought forth into law, that a Jewish child would be traumatized to brain death seeing Nazis marching there in Skokie.
So,
of interest is that the people involved with this opposition to the march of the Nazi party, after the Supreme Court, essentially after the ACLU took over and got this to the Supreme Court, and all of these laws were nullified as being unconstitutional, the group that was involved there in Skokie essentially died down, but they reemerged at the end of the 80s, actually the beginning of the 80s, and as a result, by the end of the 80s, the very same people that were involved with trying to enact laws, which were all put down by the Supreme Court, had changed their tactics. And their tactics were to bring forth a Holocaust education law in the state of Illinois, which they did. And using the, and they had also, before they enact, before they brought pressure to bring this law forth, they had also already produced the literature, the pamphlets, all of the things that they felt were necessary in order to bring this kind of education in public schools, just as what happened in the state of Florida. But they were the very same people. Which I've been able to identify, and I've made a note of this in my book. In other words, what I'm saying is, from the standpoint of how they reacted to the Nazi party in 1977, 78, 79, as essentially bigots in their own right, where they were going to deny other people the right of free expression, then when the ACLU came into the picture, because what they were doing was unconstitutional, the ACLU members began to get hate calls and death threats from this esteemed Jewish community. Now, I'm sure most people are of the awareness that hate crimes suggest that the only people essentially who commit crimes are of this nature are racist, and that they belong to the white community. Virtually no place do you ever find that the Jews themselves could, participate in any kind of acts of violence whatsoever. But if you look into the Skokie situation, and you look in the chapter in my book in which I cover this, this is indeed the case. Say there was a tremendous amount of outburst of hatred and death threats against the ACLU, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Then by the end of the 1980s, the same group had changed its tactics to education. So instead of trying to arrange for absurd laws, which they had done back in 1970-78 and so forth, now they felt that the quest was to indoctrinate the children of the state of Illinois in a manner that when they became adults, they would be sufficiently conditioned never to be a danger to the Jewish community, which I think is certainly a brilliant endeavor. I wish I'd thought of it. I could use it perhaps to sell my book or something. But whatever the case, it's brilliant. And the point is also is that people have swallowed this hook, line, and center, and sinker, because of the sense of guilt, which Steven Spielberg is one of the greatest proponents of this sort of thing. And in fact, when the Holocaust bill in Florida was being considered, the president of the Senate, I believe, was sent a letter by Steven Spielberg in which he was encouraging this law to be passed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he has produced Schindler's List and other Holocaust books, which has certainly brought a great many tears to the eyes of people seeing Jews being killed in the Holocaust and so forth. Well, you know, the other thing, of course, is that there were many other people killed during World War II. It was estimated that probably the communists alone have killed close to between 80 and 100 million people. And if you look into communism, it began with Karl Marx with Das Kapital back in 1848. And from there, Lenin was part Jewish, Trotsky was a Jew. Many of the outstanding proponents of communism in the Soviet Union were Jewish, including Beria, who was head of the secret police.
Hey, Phil?
No.
We're out of time.
Okay.
Well, thanks for being my guest. Okay. Take care. Yahweh bless.
Okay. Good luck.
Take care. All right, folks. We'll hope to see you next week, Yahweh willing. Take care and Yahweh bless. Good night.
Galaxy 7, Transponder 14, Audio 7.71 Wideband. The Heritage Broadcast System.